Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Office Hours, where we sit down with the chief executives shaping the world, and we answer your most pressing questions about leadership, careers, and life. I'm Mike Steib, and today we welcome to the show someone who has been working tirelessly to improve your neighborhood. Sarah Fryer is the CEO of Nextdoor, the hyperlocal social networking app, which went public in 2021. Previously, she was CFO of Square and took that company public as well in 2015. She started her career with stints at McKinsey & Company, Goldman Sachs, and Salesforce. She serves on a number of boards, including Walmart, and co-founded Ladies Who Launch, a community and resource for female entrepreneurs. Sarah, I'm so glad we caught you while you were in New York. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. You even heated up New York a little bit. It's not quite as cold as it was.
It's not quite as cold, but it's not great. I mean, you know, my family wants to go skiing for President's Day, and I was like, are you sure?
Yeah.
Are you sure? Freezing. It's too much. We got a bunch of questions from the audience, some on your career, some on Nextdoor, and the social graph, and your background in finance, and all of it. So if it's all right, we'll let it rip.
Let's dive right in.
All right. The first one came by voicemail from Enrique in Mountain View. He said,
when Nextdoor launched, the conventional wisdom was that there was not room for another social network. Today, it's my most used social app, and I think that's true for a lot of people. How did Nextdoor break through despite powerful competitors like Facebook?
So, Enrique, thank you for that question. Thanks for being a great neighbor. And if there was one word, I would say it's focus. Mm-hmm. So when you start anything, you got to start right at the point where you know you're going to get highest and best product market fit, to use a good kind of tech term. Mm-hmm. And Nextdoor started out as being the social network for your neighborhood, but is oh so much more. But we've always been all about local. We own the local knowledge graph. Yep. And I think that focus is what's helped us now get to over 85 million people using the platform. Yep. Across 11 countries. What I've always loved about Nextdoor is, to me, it's a global phenomenon. Everyone's a neighbor. Wherever you show up in the world, whether you agree mm-hmm. with how they run their countries, what they do in their countries, local will still matter. So focus has been everything. Now, that said, the danger of Nextdoor is what someone once described to me as, oh, you're going to die from overeating. And I was like, what do you
right,
mean by that?
Right, it does everything. I've got yes. maps, I've got offers, I've got nonprofits yeah. in my community. There's a lot of lost dogs, the whole deal.
A lot of things can be
so
local.
How do you tie us from focus
yep.
to what is certainly a multi-purpose app for my neighborhood?
So as we have grown, our ability, obviously, to do more things compounds because we become a bigger organization. But even today, we really think about three, we call them jobs, that our neighbors are trying to get done. Number one is discuss and discover. So everything that's going on around me locally, help me find the best plumber, help me find the best park for my mm-hmm. toddler. The second is more of a commercial journey, what we'd call for sale and free. So we have a huge marketplace.
Yep.
Today, over $1 billion a month is posted on Nextdoor. And about a quarter of it is actually posted for free, where people are upcycling, recycling. But that journey of why do people come to Nextdoor for that? Number one is trust, because it's real neighbors. Yep. And number two is local. And then the third area for us is connect. And that's all about the community part of Nextdoor. How do we help you find the local group that you need? Like in my case,
right. There's like a bowling group. The bowling dads who get together in the neighborhood
all and of all that. And you'll find it's like this very, very specific too, right? There's all, when you ask people for like local groups, they'll say the mom's group, the bowling group, the running group. But I find the specificity is what makes Nextdoor so beautiful.
Right.
Like in my neighborhood, you'll find salsa dancers of Marin. I live in the North Bay. There's woodworkers of Mill Valley. So I love the specificity of local.
Right.
Because it could only show up in that community.
And which of those is your group?
I'm all of the above. I can woodwork while I salsa dance.
I have to, there was also, I remember when I joined, there was a lot of friction to join, mm-hmm. right? Whereas, you know, most social networks, when I joined, I picked a handle. It didn't have to be me. I didn't have to verify it. I had to prove my address.
Right.
I was only allowed to live in one area. Mm-hmm. And that must have slowed growth for you. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it certainly did a lot to build trust that the people in my neighborhood were legit.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's very much on purpose. You're exactly right. So a core tenant of Nextdoor is it's real people at real addresses. That has the positiveness of, first of all, building trust in the neighborhood. So
right.
you know when you get on there that we have taken the time to make sure these really are your neighbors that you're talking to. It's not a bot. It's not an algorithm. Yeah. It's a real person.
And neighbors invite other neighbors to join.
They do. And they also kind of keep an eye on the neighborhood too. They make sure these truly are my neighbors that are on there. It also helps our business model because in the end, advertisers want to make sure that they're putting advertising to real people.
Right.
So being able to also make that part of how we monetize, the two have to go together, right? We're a for-profit. We need to have a P&L that matches our aspiration of cultivating a kinder world where everyone has a neighborhood to rely on.
Right.
But the two things have to go together. And that's where being built on trust from the get-go really works well, both to bring new neighbors to the platform, bringing other stakeholders in like public agencies or small businesses, but it also is really important to our business model.
I'm going to jump ahead to a question that was texted to us from Paul in Detroit. And this is an area of real interest for me too. He says, I'm a local journalist and for the last 20 years, have watched our newsrooms get smaller and smaller as the local business model has struggled. Do you see a sustainable business model for local? And are there lessons to apply? This is the first part of his question. I wanted to give you a chance to...
Yeah, I do see a business model. I see multiple business models, right? The one that we have chosen to start with is the ad model. And mm-hmm. we've seen other social platforms do incredibly well for that. The reason I'm in New York is I'm spending a bunch of time with customers, potential customers here, because a lot of advertisers are actually, they may feel like big national companies, like take the Walmarts of the world. At the same time, they act incredibly locally.
Of course.
And often they are the place where the store manager might be the person that sponsors the local school yeah. football team, right? So you get these wonderful kind of like loops that go on locally. So advertising can be a very powerful model for us from an enterprise perspective. But there's also no place today, like the Yellow Pages has kind of died. People used to stick things up in the local supermarket, right? If you had a side hustle,
sure.
if you were a dog walker
sure.
or whatever. How do you get your business known today if you're starting from scratch? Nextdoor is a beautiful place for that as well. So we can go literally from the dog walker, the babysitter, the house cleaner, all the way up to some of the largest companies in the world. Because what are they trying to do? They want to find new customers at a local level. They want to upsell and cross-sell to those customers. But often they want to reinvest back in the community and show mm-hmm. up authentically. So
right.
that is a beautiful business model. And it's one that has driven us, you know, from private company into the public markets.
As you think about where Paul's coming from, where he's thinking about local news
mm-hmm.
and local journalism, and there's all this research that shows our democracy suffers
Absolutely.
When local news suffers, you
yep.
have more polarization, less local engagement, et cetera. Is there something that you're learning in the business model mm-hmm. that can be applied more broadly? Is there something that traditional local media maybe has been missing as mm-hmm. their business model seems to be really struggling to keep up with the cost of creating the content?
Absolutely. You know, we actually work today with a lot of newsrooms across the country. I think we have about 600 local news organizations that can API, use a tech term, into Nextdoor to put their content on the platform. What I've seen in terms of engagement is if we put their content on the platform, right, they say, I want a partnership with Nextdoor and I want to put this content into your, it doesn't get great engagement relative to user-generated content. Mm-hmm. We have tried a second route, which is let's get the journalist, who is also a neighbor, to make the post. So now we've got like a human posting.
Right.
Again, not great, better engagement, not great engagement. The best engagement is when that news article is written and a neighbor posts it. And again, it's because it's coming now with editorial. It's like, hey, you know, did you just see this got posted in your local paper about the town council meeting last night?
Sure.
I disagree with this. So this tells me that there is a place for great journalism, because to your point, it is a cornerstone of democracy, but it has to be done together with a community. Now, how do we close that loop and help those journalists get paid for what they do? I don't think we've gotten the whole way there yet, because today we're still dependent somewhat on whoever they write for to have come up with the business model to pay the journalist. But I think there's something really interesting here. In some ways, influencers on social media are maybe already a step ahead, but how do we get journalists to almost act as individual influencers to make sure they keep the integrity of the institution in a way? But then how do we get them distribution that ultimately ends in a business model? I think there is a loop to be closed there.
Yeah.
We've not gotten the whole way there yet, but I do think it is absolutely vital. It's why I tend to lean into, you know, different organizations, like the 19th is a great example, which sponsors women and particularly women of color in the newsroom.
We've seen seeds of this, right? You, national journalists especially really leaned into Twitter. And we saw what a big role news played on Facebook until Facebook decided that it wouldn't.
Right.
So certainly it feels like there are lots of green shoots in this area. The second part of Paul's question was that Nextdoor is not yet profitable. How does it get there?
Right. And that is really in the end just matching, you know, growing, continuing to grow our revenue.
And you all have roughly 200 million annual run rate of revenue.
Exactly.
And about 300 of costs.
That's exactly right. But if you think about it, we are a scaled business. At this point in time, our ability to keep growing our revenue without having to grow
every
our
next
costs
dollar of revenue goes right to the bottom line.
Exactly. So Nextdoor is not a huge, you know, for kind of holding up. I often think of us like standing with this ginormous kind of world on our shoulders of 85 million plus users. We're actually quite a small company underneath that in terms of people. And this is the beauty of technology. It's such an incredibly scaled business, right? We have gross margins that are in the mid 85 type range. So when you start with gross margins there, then it is really about how do we drive to scale from here? Part of it is we've been doing a lot of investing, for example, in being a more global footprint. We only monetize really today in the US, the UK, a few other like Canada and New Zealand, or Netherlands, but small. But we have built a base, right? About 20% of our active users come outside the US, but only 10% of our revenue. So you can see already there's also a move to be made as we go more global.
Well, I think that's such a useful insight, especially for those of us who are in tech, where it felt like you had to add people to add revenue forever. Mm-hmm. I will look back on the days when I used to tell people my biggest problem is we just can't hire fast enough.
Yes.
And my company hit profitability last year. And from that moment forward, you could see that almost every dollar of revenue now goes to the bottom line.
Right.
It's this, it's a tipping point. And it sounds like that tipping point is not that far out for all of you.
Exactly. In fact, our stated goal is to be cash flow positive at the end of 25. So we kind of already see that runway
see the
right
glide
in front of us.
Yeah.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The next question ties in to this nicely. It's related to your background. It's from Catherine in Boston, who asked, I'm an FP&A. Financial planning and accounting, and would like to understand, how does your background in finance serve you as a leader and make you different from CEOs who started in engineering or sales?
Yeah. So I would kind of start out by saying, Catherine, don't overly define yourself as like, I am this type of person, because I think a great career is often built on many, many different kind of pieces that weave in. In fact, usually what I tell people when they come to me and say, I do this, I'm like, don't tell me it in job terms. Tell me, what are you great at? Are you a great communicator? Are you wonderful at analyzing data? Are you super innovative, right? Finance people can be super innovative. Their job just doesn't have to be analyzing data. So that's number one. I do find I fall back a lot on the fact I started my career actually as an engineer. I was an engineer coming out of school. But that said, what I do think that finance people have really going for them is, number one, they are incredibly numerate. They're very good with numbers. They can stare at data and very quickly spot patterns. Secondly, I think great finance people, and I hope you are one of these, and if not, I'm going to send you out into your organization and beyond to become a great one, is going and kind of living side by side with your customer and really garnering empathy. The best thing that happened to me at Square was when Jack said, I want you to start a business. And I helped, you know, along with an amazing group of people, our Square Capital business, which was our lending business. It makes sense. I ran a lot of risk at Square, so we wanted the person who ran a lot of risk in finance to have eyes on a lending product. But it really gave me so much empathy of what it was like for a product manager starting that first kind of trying to get product market fit, what it meant for that designer who was trying to make the UI UX work well, what it meant for the engineer coding in the background, because it was a startup within a startup. And I think it made me a much better CFO ultimately for the whole organization, because suddenly I could understand why maybe when I asked them to be perfect at forecasting, they weren't, because it turns out things just don't work straight up and to the right.
Sure.
the way Excel does. I'm like, what happened? In the same way, frankly, in my career, you know, I took that motion through Goldman, where I was a research analyst. You know, I found myself on these calls asking these executives, like, what happened? Like 90 days ago, you told me you were going to do X. Why haven't you done it? And now I run real companies. I'm like, oh, yeah, because the first thing you had to do is go hire someone. And it turns out it takes longer than 90 days just to find someone.
Our CFO at my last company, Jillian, had been a research analyst with Mary Meeker, who I think is on your board.
Yes, that's right.
And what Jillian was, she's great at a bunch of things. One of the things she was so great at is because she had sat in that seat mm-hmm. as a research analyst. Mm-hmm. She would do the earnings call that she wanted to hear,
yes.
rather than the one that she want, you know, that I wanted to give. She would let me give the one that I wanted to give. And my CFO now, Jeffrey, was by a lot of his background, a deal guy and a lawyer. Yeah. And so you see when somebody has that spike in their background,
yeah.
Jeff sees around the corners to the deals.
Yeah.
Jillian was so magical on a number of things, including IR and my background. I'm like a rescue dog, so mm-hmm. I don't have any one thing to point to, but.
But
you can see the way it spikes.
Totally.
For folks.
And you have what I call range. And usually when people come to me asking for career advice, I always point them to go read the book Range. Because I love idea. It's this idea that, you know, the archetype of someone with range is Leonardo da Vinci. And I think it's because I both read the Walter Isaacson biography at the same time that I was reading Range. And if you think about someone over here, you know, in Da Vinci's case, right, who's an artist, but in order to be a better artist, he literally goes to the morgue and starts cutting up corpses, which helps him understand blood flow, which helps him understand water flow, which makes him an amazing architect for dams. And it's that, I think when you called yourself a rescue dog, you can see patterns emerge that you can then apply in other situations. Mm-hmm. And so going back to that question, don't make yourself an FP&A person. You're not. You have seen examples of things happen in your career.
That's right.
How could you not go apply them if you were in a job with a totally different name on the door?
I think great advice for Catherine. And I'll drop the book Range in the show notes. I haven't read this one, so I'll put it up next. For me, I've got the next one from Linda in Mobile, Alabama.
Local communities across America have frayed as people have moved online and institutions like churches have become less important in people's lives. What role has technology played in all of this? And what do you think is the future role of technology?
So lots been written on this. Loneliness and teens not engaging socially and people sort of point to the internet and social media as the culprit.
Yeah.
Give us your take on that situation and then what's going to fix it?
I mean, it's long before the internet. In fact, probably the best work on this is Dr. Putnam's work out of Harvard, Bowling Alone.
Yeah.
And so really, it actually starts in the 50s. Pre the 50s, America in particular, his work is done on the U.S., is this incredibly, this society that's very much brought together by community, right? People belong to the local fire department, like they volunteer. You're on the front stoop in your neighborhood. Everybody knows everyone. And then TV comes along. And suddenly people move off the stoop back into a living room. It's supposed to be a communal kind of entertainment, but it's not because each of us is having a little bit of our own interaction with that show. Then you fast forward to now the beginning of the PC.
My kids can't watch a movie without also watching
their
tablet where they're also chatting with their friends.
Absolutely. And it no doubt it has rewired us. And in a world, there's that beautiful phrase that someone said, you know, in a world that's never been more connected, we've never been more alone. And we, even next door, have sponsored a lot of research around loneliness and what can be the antidote to loneliness. So a lot of people admire the problem, and it's an awful problem. But I'm looking for the solution. And so one of the things we found working with a researcher out of BYU, Julianne Holt-Lunstad, is that knowing six neighbors or more, but that's the moment where from a stat-sig perspective, you start to feelings of social isolation diminish. So my dream is you go for your annual checkup with your doctor and he asks you, are you exercising? Are you smoking? Hopefully you're not smoking. I hope you're moderating your alcohol consumption. And do you know six neighbors? Because we often don't ask the right question, right? For older people, doctors often will ask things like, what do you have for dinner? And they should be asking, who do you have dinner with? That is a way better question to know about someone's likelihood to either fall victim to other diseases, but to live longer, do you have real social interaction or are you lonely? So in Nextdoor's case, my goal is that we help people meet six neighbors. And it can be in small ways, like just remembering to pick your head out of your phone and say hello to people on, you know, as you pass their house, maybe throw their paper up onto the stoop, whatever it is. Or it might be in a moment like their own crisis. They've lost their pet. They need someone to dig them out in a snowstorm. Like small acts of kindness, yeah, they're very good for your neighbor, but you know what the secret is? They're great for you. They actually cause a physiological response that creates a psychological response. So that's just some of the research we've done, but you can tell we feel really strongly about this. And I think it's a big part of why we exist as a company.
Right. And you're bringing those neighborhoods together mm-hmm. and all that great stuff.
Exactly.
You know, a place where they seem to get it right is I visited my parents in a retirement community a few years ago, mm-hmm. and I went for a run. And one of my parents' neighbors, like blocks and blocks away, flagged me down. And so I thought there was trouble. I came over and said, is everything okay? And this older gentleman said to me, you know, I used to run. Oh. And I thought, oh, he stopped me to talk.
Yeah. What are you doing?
Could you imagine that happened
in
New York?
Would you like to text me?
But there, people move to a community like that with the intent of knowing their neighbors and socializing and doing the lawn bowling together and all that fun stuff. And there's not enough of that in the country. It's nice that you're creating that through your app. The next question is from AJ in London. What role is Gen AI playing in your products now? And what do you foresee in the future?
I love that. So we are a platform about data. I think I said, you know, I came to Nextdoor back in the day because I believe in the purpose, but also unique data. Being the local knowledge graph is a very unique place to be playing, right? Very dynamic, constantly being refreshed based on neighbor conversations every single minute, hour, day in the app. But what we've done specifically from a Gen AI perspective, so the minute we saw ChatGPT last November, we're like, this is big.
This is
so
cool.
Let's look inside our app. So very quickly, we're actually one of the first apps to launch a Gen AI assistant. So today, if you're on Nextdoor and you're creating a post, let's say, you know, I'm like, help, it's my daughter's birthday this weekend. She loves ice cream cake. I totally forgot to order one. Where could I go? We would rewrite that post for you. You hit the little blue button, it rewrites it, and it'll rewrite it based on training on our data of what post will be more engaging.
Either more, exactly. More brevity or more emojis or...
All of the above. And but 70% of people click, yeah, I'd love that. Let me take that suggestion, which is actually a huge number in tech. I was shocked. I thought our data might be wrong. The fact that 70% of people were like, yeah, let's take that.
Well, we were trained, though, with the spell check button, right? You do expect that the technology is supposed to help you along
the
way.
You.
And
yeah.
So this is an advancement of that.
And actually, what we see inside the data is businesses. So local businesses are 2 times more likely than a neighbor to accept the rewrite as well, which also tells me that there's a lot of commercial element in here too.
In fact,
early after ChatGPT launched, I was in Denver for Ladies Who Launch. You mentioned our nonprofit, and I was with a group of women, and I was like, "Hey, have you looked at this?" Because they're all using platforms like Nextdoor, but also the other social media platforms to get the word out about their businesses. And for many of them, they're not marketers, right? You know, sole proprietors or people starting their own company, they are the CEO, the CFO, the GC, the marketer, the everything. And they don't have time to be perfect CMOs. And so when I showed them, hey, you can ask this thing to write your next post for social in the style of a LinkedIn post, of an Instagram post, of a Nextdoor post, they was like saucer-eyed. Oh my God,
wow.
This is amazing. So I think that there is a real opportunity with businesses. And then finally, the last place we've used it is, well, hopefully it won't be the last, but the other place we launched at the same time was in moderation. So you talked about the work we're willing to do in order to create a welcoming platform, to slow people down, to make onboarding a little harder, mm-hmm. to make sure you're a real person. So in this case, we have something called Kindness Reminder. If you're writing a post that our ML, our machine learning says, hey, this post is going to get moderated, it will pop up something in real time that says, hey, neighbor, great communities are created with kindness. What we're doing there is bringing you back to your frontal lobe over your
this
bias.
This should be a browser plugin for the whole internet.
I agree. Maybe for the world, just even in real life.
I love it.
And that's a place where we also put forth a more constructive way to say something. And I really think this is important because I don't want to shut down tough conversations. Like a lot of people's response to, oh, things are getting heated, let's not talk about this. I don't buy that either. I grew up in Northern Ireland in the Troubles. If we all hadn't learned to talk about really tough things around a table, we would have never gotten to peace. But I think it's about helping people say things in a more constructive way. You're usually not in the business of trying to change people's minds. Most people will not ultimately change their mind. But maybe you can just inject that little bit of like empathy of like, huh, I hadn't thought about it that way, which might slightly move people maybe more to a common ground.
We have a similar feature on, I'm on the board of change.org, where if you want to create change, first you have to create a petition and you put it out there into the world and people come and support the petition and ultimately decision makers are connected to it and may decide to do something about it. But that first step is really hard. You're like, I know we're using too much public space for free parking.
Right.
And I want to start a petition, but you don't know all the research. You don't have all of the data. And we did a Gen AI plugin where you push the button now with your ideas and it turns it into not only well written, but it also will, when you need it, pull the research to help you get over the finish line.
Perfect.
It's really magical, sort of that intersection of the intent of an engaged member of the community with the capabilities of these models that we're just starting to figure out. Adrian in Redmond says,
women face all kinds of obstacles professionally, but are increasingly at the center of the tech world. Can you talk about how that is playing out in your organizations?
It's just so vital. If we don't, first of all, it's a business imperative. If we don't look like our customers, we cannot even pretend we're serving them. Because just by nature, we all bring our own biases to the party. And so if you get a diverse group of people around the table, I think ultimately you can create something that works better for everyone that wants to be your customer. And the stats show this too, in terms of the performance of companies that have more diverse leadership teams.
Although there's actually research that shows as you add women to teams and remove men, the teams get better without diminishing returns. Up to including having zero men. So I sometimes joke, like, I'll turn the lights off on my way out and wish everyone the best. But there is real research to suggest that because women are more likely to bring empathy and better listening and et cetera to team environments, that you're crazy not to have a team that has a large composition of women.
Yeah. I do think that where the world has gone from a technology perspective, you know, Silicon Valley in some ways bowed to the, I would call it the IQ gene, right? Computer science was everything. Not to ding it. I was an engineer myself. Gen AI is going to change that. Suddenly coding is being democratized. Suddenly anyone can create some lines of code.
Yes.
And that's a very interesting thing for where we head in terms of our schools and universities and so on. But when you put EQ and IQ together, that's when problems get really hard. And if you want to work on the hardest problems, I would kind of tell yourself, go work at the intersection. And I think this is a place where women can excel because of many of the more, I don't want to be gender stereotypical, but a lot more kind of focus on communication, on collaboration, on trying to get into the shoes of customers, but then combining that with hardcore data, you know, really strong science abilities, like that's nirvana. And that might not just be a female thing. I mean, those are just great people that we should be bringing through organizations, giving them a voice and making sure that we're nurturing them into senior roles.
Totally. I think the majority of my directs for the last 12 or 15 years have been women and the teams are just much, much better, much, much better for it. And I'm not telling you anything that you don't already know, but I certainly support that. Sven in Hudson Valley wants to know,
what's the weirdest thing you've seen posted on Nextdoor?
The weirdest thing, I'm going to take it the weirdest thing that's happened to me on Nextdoor, which it's close. So during COVID, we're all at home and beyond just, you know, running this platform and wanting to see it grow, I wanted to be a part of my community. I literally was like, I need to do something. And this wonderful woman kind of popped up. She'd created a help group in my community and she was kind of pairing people off. And you know, I was like, I could do something at the weekend. She was like, okay, I need you to go to the CVS or whatever and get this person their weekly pharmacy or whatever it was. So it was great. I did that. And then she was like, oh, you're a doer. Will you do something else? And she was slowly trying to give me work. And eventually I was like, oh, I have like a full-time job too, but you know, I'll keep doing this. And then she kept pinging me on things. And then eventually she called me and she started to speak and she had a Northern Irish accent.
Oh, wow.
And Northern Ireland is the size of a pea. So it's very rare that you bump into people from Northern Ireland. There's a lot of Irish people in the US, a lot of people who have Irish heritage, but finding someone from Northern Ireland in your backyard, and we just became fast friends. And it's was so,
that's
it
wonderful.
Was like the universe spoke to me. So I don't know if that's weird or funny. There's plenty of funny things I see on Next Door too.
I think you pivoted that very well because there's some weird stuff. My favorite is always when some like local kid plays pranks in the neighborhood and people keep posting it saying, stop doing this. I'm like, don't your only feed the kid who's carving the inappropriate stuff in everyone's pumpkins or leaving a sandwich in your mailbox. I think they are like wonderful examples of the off-piste stuff that happens in a community. And it's always somebody's 15-year-old.
Totally.
Who's like just out there having a good time.
And so. It's generational. Honestly, we're kind of built to, you know, the 15-year-old's going to be the person in like 60 years that's like annoyed with the 15-year-old. I kind of feel like it's part of how the universe has to work to keep us all in balance.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The last one is from Malik in Kansas City. He wants to know, with what you know now, what advice would you give yourselves at 25 or 30?
Yeah, so like one thing that I always come back to, I would buy a lot of Bitcoin, or ETH actually is my thing, but either way, you do well with both. I always come back to this thing about perfection that I feel like as a young woman growing up when I did, and I think it's still true today, I think girls foist a lot of perfectionism on themselves to be the A student, to do everything perfectly, to get full marks in all their tests, and while on the one hand it's great, and then you tend to get praised for it and lauded for it, and that only compounds this feeling of like I have to be the best at everything. But it can become a real limiter on your enjoyment in life, but also just your ability to take risks. And I think it's something I really watch for a lot. I have a teenage girl. She's got the perfection gene, and I'm constantly trying to push her away from it to say, mm-hmm. it's okay if you don't get an A in this test. Like, I might be the only parent on the planet that's like, I'm okay if you don't do this because I want you to go out and have fun one right. night or two nights or whatever. But that perfection thing is, it's hard to shake. And I think in my 20s, you know, on the other side, I wonder, would I be doing all I did if I didn't have to be X amount better often than everyone else around the table? But I do think that perfection gene is a tough one. And I think in my 20s in particular, it was very, very strong. Today, I'm much more kind of confident in who I am, and you kind of get what you take.
I think it's great advice. And, you know, mine,
take what you get. Sorry.
You get what you take. Take what you get. mine rhymes a lot with yours, which is, I think earlier in your career, for me, earlier in my career, being ambitious and wanting to have an impact, there's a good amount of fake it till you make it. Mm-hmm. But what it causes you to do if you're not careful is act like you know rather than ask good, smart questions.
Right.
And if I could give myself one piece of advice at 25 or 30, it would be ask more and ask better questions.
Yeah.
And at one point, it was my New Year's resolution. I will ask better questions. And I kept track of, am I asking better questions mm-hmm. today? And I think I know for a fact, I mean, it made me a better learner and a better teammate and ultimately a better leader.
Yeah. And the two are interconnected, if I could say that, because sometimes when you feel the need to be perfect, you feel like anytime someone asks you a question, you have to have the perfect answer. Right. And I'm about to, after we finish here, go have a drink with someone who was the audit chair of Square. And he used to always tell me right ahead of every earnings call, it is perfectly acceptable to say, I don't know, but I'll find that out for you and come back to you with it.
Yeah.
A much better answer than either fake it till you make it or feeling like you had to come back exactly then with an answer. Sometimes it's okay to wait to not know. And in some ways, sometimes that inspires a more robust conversation
yeah.
instead of coming off as I have all the answers.
And I certainly applied this with investors where they would say, why aren't you doing this? Or what do you mm-hmm. think about that? It's always a moment for you to say to someone who has great pattern recognition because they're invested in a lot of companies. They spend a lot of time in this. Say, what would you do if you were me? What do you see? What do you think we're missing? And then you have to answer the question too, because that's why they have the earnings calls. Sarah, this was super fun.
Thank you.
We are all of us, all 85 million of us who are on the app are super appreciative of the work you do and the company and the kindness that comes through talking to you. It comes through in your products too. And it's to yours and the team's credit. So
yeah,
thank you.
Totally. Team effort. Thank you.
You know, friends, on this podcast, we tend to talk a lot about how technology is reshaping industries. And I especially enjoyed today's conversation because it's not only about how technology is affecting businesses, but it's about how technology has, over the past decades, affected our personal lives, our communities, and our neighborhoods. And in the case of Sarah's work and the work of the good folks at Nextdoor, how technology is changing the way for the better that we engage in our local communities. And when you think expansively about what local means, whether it's local news and journalism, supporting local businesses, it's an area I personally have a lot of passion, and I know a lot of our listeners do. I'm really excited to see in this next phase of technology, the next arc of the growth of our industries, how tech comes back to local markets and brings people together and helps more of these businesses and institutions and neighborhoods thrive. Today was a really fun interview. I hope you all enjoyed it as much as I did. We've got a week off and then some amazing guests coming up. Don't forget, you can text or call in your questions at 213-419-0596 or just hit me up on LinkedIn, Instagram, etc. at Mike Steib. I want to thank Sarah and of course Jen, Jada, Matt, and the whole team at Blue Duck Media for pulling this all together. Dylan, Sasha Gay, and the iHeart crew, our friend Vahid here in the studio, and Ben and the team at William Morris Endeavor for all their support. Office Hours is a production of Blue Duck Media, and we are distributed by iHeartRadio. Have a great week, everybody. Stay on your grind.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf-Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.